Omelette and Eggs, Part 4. Henri and I spent the evening tailing Rufus. The revelation that we would use Friday night to follow a suspect pleased neither of our wives, but they reacted in slightly different manners. Liz did not scream, yell, or threaten me with bodily harm, but she reminded me that it was my turn to cook dinner that evening, and our double indemnity rule was still in effect. That is, if one of us misses a turn at making dinner because of circumstances, any less than a nuclear holocaust, then said person will cook the next two family dinners. I got off easy. Swoozy screamed, yelled, and threatened Henri with permanent scarring and loss of bodily parts. From across the room, I could hear her on the phone. She's not quite as understanding as Liz is. Her background as a voodoo priestess in Haiti may explain that difference in world views. Henri calmed his spouse as best he could, but it seemed to have little effect. I was glad I wouldn't be around their house later that evening. I would have to remind my partner to unload his revolver before he went home. The first 3 hours of our stakeout were nothing to speak of. Rufus had dinner and lounged around her home. We sat out in my car a block from his house and dozed. He and Cornelia lived in the North Augusta suburb of Hammond Hills. The house was perched on a small hill facing Georgia and overlooking the Savannah River. The area and house were nice, but not quite as posh as I would have expected from the widow of Winston Anderson, Chicken King. At about 9 o'clock, Rufus left the house. I'm not sure what I expected from old Uncle Roof, but somehow I wasn't surprised when we followed him to a Dunkin' Donuts shop. He spent the next half hour devouring 2 dozen donuts and about a gallon of coffee. I set Henri in to see if our suspect was in the middle of any interesting conversations, but my partner came back with a half dozen French crullers and nothing interesting to speak of.
"He's talking with the cops in there about catfishing down at some place called Capers Lake. He ain't talking about chickens,"
Henri informed me. After donuts, Rufus headed out to a Walmart on the Georgia side of the Savannah. Again, I sent Henri in after him. After minutes of tedious waiting, Henri came back to tell me that he was not buying chicken feed or anything else a chicken might need or desire. He was purchasing baby shampoo and shotgun ammo. "Great," I mused with a raised eyebrow. "Guess he's going to shampoo a bear and then shoot it. Or maybe the other way around." Rufus's next stop was an old gray brick bar and grill on Mars Street with the unlikely name of the Cork and Fork Tavern. I tried to convince Henri to go in and eavesdrop on Uncle Roof, but he wouldn't do it this time.
"He's probably already seen me at the Walmart and donut shop, man. I'd be pushing it if I went in there now. I'm sure he'd notice me and suspect something funny," said the Haitian.
I agreed with Henri, so we waited in the parking lot across the street. As the evening got later, the cold entered my bones more and more. I shivered and my teeth chattered. I was getting too old for these late-night stakeouts. I would have to get a younger partner soon to team up with Henri on this grunt work stuff. I was the brains of the operation, after all. There was no need for me to suffer from the elements. It was almost midnight before Rufus left the Cork and Fork. He'd been in there so long, I was surprised when he didn't stagger to his pickup truck. His step was surprisingly sure and light. He started his truck with a churning whine and pulled out onto Mars Street. I had been quite certain he was going home. I was a bit surprised when he headed south, away from South Carolina. "Where's he going?" I muttered.
"To Winston the Chicken, of course."
I shook my head. "Maybe not. Why would he keep the chicken so far from home? I know he's an idiot, but wouldn't even an idiot keep it nearby for convenience's sake?" Henri shrugged.
"I don't know. I ain't never kidnapped no one for."
The late-night traffic was light, but we were still able to keep well enough back so that Rufus did not spot us. We stayed fairly inconspicuous until he turned off south onto Deansbridge Road. At that point, the traffic around us completely dried up. I turned off my headlights. I'd have to navigate by the taillights of Rufus's truck now. I hope he didn't decide to pull off into a ditch somewhere. "What's in this direction, Henri?" He thought for a moment before answering.
"The rear end of Fort Gordon, but he might get off for then."
"I don't think so," I said thoughtfully. I had a suspicion that Rufus's secret lay near Fort Gordon, where he said he'd been hunting on Wednesday night, the night that Winston disappeared. Would he have brought Winston all the way down here? Maybe, but why? After a few minutes of driving without headlights, my eyes became better accustomed to the dark. I could make out the pale ribbon of road before me and the shadowed woods to either side. Rufus stayed on Deansbridge Road until the Shadow Lake exit, where he turned off onto Indian Hills Trail. Was he heading for Shadow Lake?
That was another place he'd mentioned in our conversation. Was he meeting his buddies out there for some reason?
Look, directed Henri. He's turning again.
Indeed, he was turning off Indian Hills Trail. The beacons of his taillights bobbed to the right, toward Shadow Lake and out of sight. It took us only moments to pull even with the turnoff. Looks like nothing more than a one-lane dirt track, I said, squinting in the moonlight at the worn tire ruts and thick trees. And it leads off into the woods. I'm not so sure it's a good idea to follow him with only one lane. We could get trapped going in as he's coming out.
I say we chance it, mon. I'm sure he ain't coming out for some time.
Yeah, but headlights suddenly appeared behind us. I could have ignored whoever it was, but something told me I shouldn't. It was the first car we'd seen out here for minutes. I was suspicious, and I never ignore my paranoid tendencies. Before the vehicle reached us, I pulled farther off the road and partially into the concealment of a big bush at the wood's edge. I waited for them to pass on Indian Hill Trail. But not completely to my surprise, the vehicle, a pickup truck, pulled onto the dirt road down which Rufus had disappeared. Thoughtfully, I stared after the retreating lights. I guess fate has decided a course of action for us, Henri. Rufus is not alone anymore, and now our chances have doubled of being caught if we drive up that dirt road. Let's walk, I said. We followed the dirt track but stayed to the woods. Four more trucks and a military jeep came barreling along through the night as we tracked through the darkness. I began to wonder what the hell we were getting into. The woods were old, at least a couple of hundred years in age. The trees were made up of beeches and maples and hickories near the road, and pines and hemlock farther in. Henri and I made easy progress. There was little to impede us at this time of year. I did fall over an unnamed bush or two, and there were tree roots and small rocks all over the place to stumble over in the semi-darkness beneath the moon, but I was as careful as I could be. The ground grew steeper and more difficult to negotiate as we neared Shadow Lake, and what I could only hope was the end of the road. My breath burned in my throat. I hoped this little expedition was worth it. The woods began to thin out as we reached the top of the hill. Panting, I motioned Henri to slow. If I remember my geography of the area correctly, the lake lay below us. More slowly, keeping low, we moved through the last few feet of trees to the very edge of the woods, and looked below. I don't believe it, I whispered fiercely when I saw the scene below us. Hell, I just don't believe it.
Believe it, mon, said Henri.
On an open patch of ground below, near the lake, burned a 10-foot-high cross. Near the cross was a portable stage lit from headlights of the pickup trucks. About 30 men were grouped around the stage. I pulled out a set of fold-up field glasses I had in my pocket and spied upon them. At first, I didn't recognize anybody, though disturbingly a good many of them wore U.S. Army uniforms. I sighed and shifted my gaze. There was no mistaking Rufus Anderson. He stood casually drinking a beer and talking to a big beer-bellied man with sergeant stripes emblazoned on his khaki sleeve. Anyone else I know? I focused on a small group near the back of the stage and recognized the red head of Enoch Steckley, the gate guard at Rural Choice. So that's his secret, I said softly to Henri. Rufus is in the Klan. What a scumbag. Henri shook his head and whispered,
No, Myron, it ain't the Klan. It's something else. See, they don't wear the family linen on their heads.
True enough. Rufus stepped up to the stage and waved his hands and smiled as if to an adoring crowd. He wore nothing more than he'd worn to the Walmart earlier in the evening. His checkered shirt, worn Levi's, and jacket. It occurred to me in a flash as I gazed at the meeting below. The jacket, of course. Most of the men down there wore jackets exactly like Rufus, with a closed steel fist embroidered upon them. It was obviously a symbol of whatever organization this was. Did this have anything at all to do with the chicken napping? We'd see, though I was beginning to have doubts. Rufus started speaking to the crowd below.
Welcome, shouted Rufus, to this meeting of the White Patriots of the Iron Fist.
Although that makes sense, doesn't it, I thought.
I bring this meeting to order. What is our purpose, brothers? Freedom!
Screamed the masked fruitcakes below in a single voice.
Yes, freedom! Shouted Rufus. We want to free this country up for all of us real Americans. We're going to get this country back from our tormentors. We will keep the bloodshed to a minimum, but anybody who gets in our way will be sorry. They will be crushed beneath our iron fist. We are going to save the dying white race.
Loud cheering arose below. Henri gave a barely audible groan beside me. A black man in the neighborhood of white supremacists is never very happy. Don't worry, I whispered. I bet these jerks don't like anybody. Below, I could see Rufus pull out a crumpled piece of paper from his pocket. He smoothed it out, faced his followers, and shook the paper above his head and shouted,
"This is a declaration of war, brothers. Let me read it to you. I declare war against coloreds, Jews, queers, assorted Mongols, papists, Arabs, white race traitors, Turks, and despicable informants."
"See," I said to Henri. Rufus continued to scream,
"War is the only way now, brothers."
And they cheered.
"So, fellow white Aryan warriors, strike now. All of you white patriots are now honor-bound and duty-bound to pick up the sword and do battle against the massed forces of evil."
Was this guy serious? Should he and his assorted nutcases be reported to the cops? I wondered about this. Maybe, but then again, maybe not. This group had to be years old. Hattie had said Rufus's jacket was ages old. If they'd been around for that long, they were probably harmless despite their violent and far from friendly attitude.
"Some people would say we represent hatred," shouted Rufus.
"Yeah, like me," I muttered.
"But we don't represent hatred in the least. We represent love. Love of purity. Love of cleanliness. Love of the white race. That's love. If that's not love, then tell me what love is."
Henri groaned again.
"I can't take much more of this, Myron. My stomach's hurting."
I nodded my understanding. "Just a little longer. This may be a dead end," I whispered.
"White people in America have to wake up and see what's happening. We ain't got no rights no more. Coloreds march and don't nobody say nothing. Somebody's got to stand up and fight for the rights of white people. Who will do that? Who?"
screamed Rufus.
"We will!"
"Yes, yes, we will!"
shouted Rufus.
"And who among us is especially prepared for the battle ahead? I will tell you who. Jimmy Earl Smith, Kilroy McIntosh, come on up here. You two boys are our new generation."
A cheering went up among the small throng as two men in their early 20s climbed up on the stage beside Rufus. Both were white. Both were fair and blonde-haired. Both wore army uniforms. Rufus put his arms around their shoulders. My stomach did flip-flops. My dad had fought against just this sort of crap in World War II, and here it was again. The beast that wouldn't die.
"And this here's our new generation. I'm proud of 'em. They're our very newest members, just inducted into our number on Wednesday night. They are true members of the white race. Pure and adulterated. I sat out here with them on their membership vigil all of Wednesday night, and let me tell you—"
I lost the rest of it as I abruptly realized what Rufus had just said. Suddenly, this entire trip out to the woods was incredibly irrelevant. Unwittingly, Uncle Ruf had informed us of his real alibi for Wednesday night. It had nothing to do with snipe hunting expeditions. He had been out here on the lake all night with his band of dreary men. He lied to protect his iron-fisted brethren. That's what he'd been hiding from me. He couldn't have had anything to do with Winston the Chicken's disappearance. Though misguided in her reasoning, Cornelia had been right. I sighed raggedly. "Let's get out of here, Henri. The stench around here is making me gag." When I woke up the next morning, every muscle in my body ached. I gave a short groan, turned over, and discovered to my surprise I was alone in bed. Liz was nowhere to be seen. It took my bleary eyes a moment to focus on the pink stationery taped to my wife's pillow. I weakly ripped it off and read, "Good morning, honey. The kids and I have gone to help out with the St. Andrew's Church Festival. You look so utterly exhausted I didn't have the heart to wake you. We probably won't be back until late this afternoon. I have no doubt that you can find something to do on your own until then. See you all later. Love, Liz." You all. Damn, I swore softly to myself. That meant no breakfast. Saturday was the only day that Liz ever made me breakfast. Her elaborate morning meals were one of the few real high points of my life. On weekdays, she was off to work long before the rest of us, so I was usually forced to suffer coffee and donuts at work. On Sunday, when Liz spent all morning on church activities, a similar fate always befell me. I am not a male chauvinist pig. I like the fact that my wife works, and I'm proud of her accomplishments. It's hard to run a successful psychology practice in the South, but I do miss all those little extras that you get with a full-time wife. I was crawling out of bed when the phone rang at my night table. "Hello," I said.
"Morning, Myron,"
came the exuberant voice of Henri in my ear.
"How's your darling Liz this morning?"
I glanced at the pink note. "She's fine, Henri. What do you want this early in the morning?"
"'Tain't early, mon. It's after 10. I've been up since 7. Don't tell me that you're just getting up now." "Well, I don't believe it. Is this what you used to do when you lived in—"
"Henri, enough. What do you want?"
"You ain't never going to believe this. I got important news about the chicken case."
"Don't tell me. You solved the case last night by yourself, right?"
"Don't be silly, mon."
"What then?"
"First of all, it will make you happy to know Lucifer's okay. The vet said I can take him home today."
"Wonderful. Just what I wanted to hear."
"I knew you'd be pleased."
"Yeah, about as pleased as a kick in the head. So what's the big news? What are you so excited about?"
"The vet told me what made me wee piglet sick."
"Do I really have to hear this, Henri?" I said, in an angry edge developing in my voice. "I don't care what made your pig sick. I don't care if your pig keels over dead and never wakes up again."
"That ain't nice, Myron," said Henri in a hurt tone. "This is important. You don't think I'd bother you if it wasn't?"
"I don't know what to expect of you sometimes. What is it?" I demanded.
"The vet said Lucifer had allergic reaction."
"A what?"
"Allergic reaction," he repeated.
"An allergic reaction? To what?"
"The carpet he ate."
"So what does that tell us? He can't eat rayon ever again?"
"No, no, you don't understand. It wasn't the carpet that made him sick. It was the red stuff staining the carpet."
Reluctantly, I said, "Go on."
"It was tomato sauce."
"The stain was tomato sauce?" I said incredulously. "Are you sure? How did this vet of yours figure it out so fast?"
"He already knew Lucifer was allergic to tomatoes. He's known it since last year when Lucifer got into Swoozy's tomato garden. My piglet coughed and hacked for a week. I even had to blow his nose for him. And he was lucky he was so sick. Swoozy would have butchered him on the spot otherwise."
"You mean your stupid pig has had this allergic reaction before?"
"Yeah."
"And you didn't recognize it this time?"
"I ain't a vet, Myron."
"No, you're certainly not, Henri," I said thoughtfully. "But you are a pretty good detective. What does this mean?"
"I'll be damned if I know."
"What would a kidnapper be doing with tomato sauce during his abduction?"
"Making chicken cacciatore."
"That's real cute," I responded sourly. For a moment, there was silence on the line between us. I concentrated on the problem, getting nothing but a headache. Chicken cacciatore? Cacciatore, I wondered. Maybe that wasn't so stupid a comment after all. Maybe. The answer was abruptly before me, staring me in the face, and I didn't like it one bit. The most obvious solution didn't make any sense at all.
"Are you there, Myron?"
asked Henri, after I'd been quiet for too long. "Yes, I'm here."
"What you thinking?"
"I'm thinking about making a couple of phone calls. Tell you what, my friend, I'm going to call you back. I have some information to root up."
"Who are you calling?"
"A couple of Jews and a racist or two."
"Why, hello, Mr. Abramowitz," said Hattie, opening the front door of her home. "We didn't expect you today. How did you and your, friend..."
She looked up at Nazareth Pike with a wary smile.
"Get in here. We didn't leave your name down at the gate for entry."
I nodded my greeting to Hattie and noticed her sister was nowhere to be seen. I hoped she was around here somewhere. "Enoch Steckley was nice enough to get us by the gate. We've become good friends since I met him yesterday, especially after I threatened to tell his boss, Hattie Anderson, about the White Patriots. He wasn't much of an Aryan warrior when it came down to it. He had decided he would rather cooperate with a Jew and keep his job than join the long unemployment lines of South Carolina and live on Georgia beaches."
"Well, wasn't that nice of him?" said Hattie. "Well, come in, come in. There's no use standing out there."
Thank you, ma'am.
So what have you got to report?
She said, closing the door behind us. She gestured to Naz.
Why have you brought along this big fellow with you?
This is my associate, Nazareth Pike. He insisted on coming along. The reasons will become clear later.
I see.
Hattie led the way to Winston's living room. We entered to find that it had indeed been cleaned thoroughly. Emma had done an incredibly efficient job of cleansing the room. The leather cushions on the couch had been replaced, the paintings and drapery rehung, the carpet cleaned thoroughly, even the chicken stench of Winston was almost eradicated. Hattie stopped by a liquor cabinet. She poured out soda into a big crystal tumbler. I walked over to one of the big picture windows and stared out at the green lawn below. Naz threw himself into a ponderous leather chair.
"Can I get you gentlemen a drink?"
I shook my head. Naz mirrored my own motion.
"You look tired, Mr. Abramowitz. Did you have a long night?"
"You might say that, Miss Anderson," I said, continuing to stare out the window.
"So what brings you here?"
"I think we solved the case. We're not sure where Winston is, but we know who took him."
"Why, that's wonderful,"
gushed Hattie.
"Absolutely wonderful. Who did it? Who's the swine who would do such a thing? Let me at them. I'll tear their ears off. I will show no mercy. While they'll blanch before me like a villain in front of a judge, they will feel my wrath. They had better not have hurt Daddy, or they will be in the most trouble you can imagine. If you tell me who they are, there will be nowhere they can escape to. I will track them down to the ends of the earth and—"
"Enough," I commanded. "Please, Hattie, you're not making this any easier."
"Well, then, just tell me, who did it?"
I hesitated, but said it. "Your sister Emma kidnapped your father the chicken." Surprise and alarm crossed the face of Hattie. Her hands flew together and she shook her head. It took her a moment to compose herself. Finally, her chubby face settled into a semblance of a smile.
"Well, that's foolishness, Mr. Abramowitz. How can you say that?"
"I have proof."
"Well, your proof is foolishness. Emma was with me on Wednesday night. We were catering a party. She could not have come home and done anything to Daddy. Besides, why ever would she do such a thing?"
"We'll get to motives later. First, the proof. Was Emma really with you all night?" Hattie screwed up her face in thought.
"Well, of course she was."
I shook my head. "No, Hattie, it's not true. You know it. The Feiersteins told me differently."
"All right, down you. But she was only gone for an hour."
"Why did she leave?"
"We were making pollo con arroz, a wonderful Mexican dish. Anyway, I forgot the tomato sauce. Emma had to go buy some more so we could complete the dish."
"Do you remember the stain on the floor there? The one that Emma removed so expertly?"
"Yes,"
said Hattie, her chins trembling. "That was tomato sauce."
I don't understand."
"Your sister raced up here from Augusta. She was so excited about what she was going to do, she forgot she had the jar of sauce in her hand when she came in. She was pressed for time. She did whatever she did to Winston and accidentally dropped the sauce. She desperately tried to clean it, but that did little good. So she tore up the room to make it look like violence had been done and to hide the sauce stain."
"Why, that is insanity. How could she possibly have had time to do all that and get back?"
I nodded my head. "Good question. I wondered that myself, so this morning I timed a trip from Berkman Village to Rural Choice. It takes 25 minutes if you break the speed limit by credible amounts. In light traffic, you could probably do it in less. Let's assume normal traffic. That means a 50-minute round trip. That leaves 10 minutes to do the dirty work. Plenty of time." Hattie shook her head.
"I don't believe it."
"How about this, then? Enoch Steckley was on guard at the gate early in the evening when Hattie came speeding through here. If you interrogate him, he will tell you that he let her through the front gate." Hattie's eyes grew wide.
"Oh, my God! What about the silver star we found?"
"It was a plant. She could have thrown it in there at any time after the kidnapping. I'm sure she ripped it off Rufus's jacket last week sometime. She needed a fall guy for all this. He was going to be it. Didn't you see how she kept pushing me in that direction? She was the one who suggested Rufus as a suspect. She was the first one to recognize the silver star."
"Oh, dear. Oh, dear, dear. I must go find Emma. I'm sure there's a logical explanation for all of this. You cannot blame this incident on my sister. She loves our daddy. She'd never do anything like this,"
said Emma from the doorway.
"I'm sorry, Hattie, but I'm afraid I would."
Nazareth Pike stood and ogled at Emma Anderson. She nodded politely at him.
"Hello, Naz."
she said placidly.
"Where's Winston, Emma?" I asked gently.
"He has long gone on to chicken heaven. I put him in with the rest of the broilers ready for slaughtering on the night I kidnapped him."
Hattie gave a little scream and slumped unconscious into a faint. I wasn't much at first aid, so I ignored her. She'd wake up eventually on her own anyway. Instead, I focused my attention on Emma. This was the first time I'd ever heard her speaking. Though her voice was under tight, anxious rein, her face was as impassive now as it had ever been. Nazareth Pike's jaw hung open.
How could you do that, Emma? How could you, of all people, do that? I thought you cared. You really cared about animals.
She shook her head.
You wouldn't understand, Naz.
Try me, then, I said sardonically. Maybe I'll understand. Does it have anything to do with Poofy, maybe? Emma's eyes grew into slits in her fat face.
Yes, yes, it does, and more. How did you know?
I'm a detective. I'm supposed to know. But that doesn't mean I understand. Explain. Please. Emma took a deep breath.
It was difficult growing up in this house. This house built upon death. The death of the innocent poultry of the world. I was unhappy from early childhood. I was 2 or 3 years old when I saw my first chicken slaughtered. I remember it well. The blood, the gore. Back then, Daddy used to help out at the processing facility. That was a long time ago, before we started massive wholesale slaughtering of birds. But I remember it, and it affected me deeply, even that young. I knew those poor birds had as much right to life as our father, but there was nothing I could do to help them.
Nazareth nodded. He obviously understood where she was coming from, though I suspect his transformation into fruitcake had taken place at a much later age than Emma's.
I grew up and went through grammar school. More and more I realized where my family's money was coming from, that the source of our riches was genocide. I grew sadder and sadder, and then Poofy died. It was Daddy's fault that Poofy died. If he hadn't been fixing a driveway that was in perfect repair, Poofy might still be around. But it confirmed one thing I already knew. The lives of animals were cheap in this world. I decided I would take my revenge upon Daddy someday. Someday, when he least expected it, he would find out what it was like to be slaughtered.
Dear God, I thought this chick is clearly off the deep end.
No, Mr. Abramowitz, I can tell from the way you're looking at me that you think I'm crazy. I am not. I only wanted justice. Justice for the millions of dead poultry. And Poofy. You understand, don't you, Naz?
I think I do, Emma.
So I bided my time and planned my revenge. But I lost out. My father died before I could show him the pain he caused his chickens.
Thank God at all his mercies, I thought.
But it was not the end of the matter. My father was not done with us. He inflicted himself upon us again. Hattie and I were forced to take care of him in his new guise as a chicken. But I plotted my revenge still. I decided that revenge would be even sweeter now. Now he would feel the true pain of a chicken as a chicken. What could be more fitting?
Not much, I muttered. Hattie groaned lowly and started to stir.
"What happened?"
she moaned.
"Where am I?"
Emma put an immense arm around Hattie's immense shoulder.
"It's all right, Hattie. Really."
Hattie shook her head weakly. Emma smiled at her and continued.
"So I planned out my revenge very carefully. I decided that if our father went into the processing plant with the rest of the chickens, that would be the most fitting punishment possible."
"So you planned to make it look like a kidnapping?" She nodded.
I wanted to put the blame on Uncle Rufus. I figured everybody would believe that. He's not exactly known to the world for his goodness.
I don't understand why you wanted to make it look like a kidnapping. Were you actually worried about keeping the fortune? I thought you said it was nothing more than blood money.
It is. I don't care about the fortune. But I love my sister, and I don't want her to lose her part of the fortune. I didn't know what would happen to her if she lost the business.
She would have become a caterer. Emma shrugged.
I guess. I didn't think about it.
You'd better think about it now, I warned, with a serious shake of my head.
The executors of your father's will probably notice that Winston the Chicken is nowhere to be seen next time they drop by. Emma nodded sadly.
That will be the price the truth brings.
Why were you so silent all those years after Poofy's death? Why only talk to your sister? Emma shrugged.
After Poofy died, I made a rule for myself. I didn't talk to anybody except vegetarians anymore, like Nazareth here. They were the only people I could trust. I knew they could never really hurt anything. They weren't murderers. That's why I joined Animals Are People, too. I knew I'd find others there like myself. I talked to my sister because I love her more than anybody, even if she does abet the slaughter of the innocents.
Why did you lie to Nez's animal group? Emma's eyes opened up wide now.
I couldn't tell them the truth. I just couldn't tell them who I really was. They would have hated me.
And the lies about the processing plant? Demanded Nez. You told me they torture and drug chickens in there.
Those weren't lies. They were the truth.
When was the last time you were in the plant, Emma? I asked. She scratched her head.
About 10 years ago, I guess.
Yeah, that's what I thought. You may find the conditions and methods have changed a bit in 10 years. It may not be quite as the child within you remembers it. Hattie groaned again.
Oh, Emma, how could you do it to Daddy? How could you?
Emma ground her teeth a bit.
He deserved it, Hattie. You know that. He murdered for years and years, and now he's paying for it.
We're going to pay for it, too, Emma. We're going to lose everything.
Oh, I'm sorry, Hattie. I didn't mean to hurt you. That's all right, Emma. I still love you.
The two sisters hugged each other and started sobbing, sobbing quite loudly. They cried in unison. They sounded for all the world like all the wailing banshees mourning all the dead and lost souls under heaven. It was really touching. Touching and extremely silly. I could only take so much of it. My stomach started to rebel. Ladies, ladies, please, listen to me, they bawled on. I shouted the louder over the blubbering roar. Ladies, ladies, please! They quieted down to a low screech. Ladies, I have a solution to your problem. Poverty need not be your final fate. I cut another piece of Melange's birthday cake. It was chocolate, layered with strawberries. My favorite. Yum. I sunk my fork into the gooey mass, oozing onto my plate. Ah, heaven. How old are you now, Melange? I smirked. Perhaps I'd get some revenge in. Unfazed, she smiled.
Old enough to know, and young enough to enjoy what I know.
Henri chuckled.
She ain't gonna tell your mon, you should know that.
I grinned evilly. She doesn't have to tell me. I have her employment file right here. I can tell you, Henri. Melange's jaw dropped, and she went as pale as she could under the heavy layers of makeup.
Really, mon, tell me, smiled Henri. So, Mr. Abramowitz, demanded Melange, desperately trying to change the subject, what did you tell the Andersons to get them out of trouble? How come they still got their fortune?
I smiled, mostly from the luscious feeling of the chocolate and strawberries in my mouth, partially from Melange's discomfort. She felt it so rarely. Simple. I asked them what Winston looked like. They told me he was nothing special, just a typical white New York Wyandotte. I said, if there's nothing special about him, just replace him with another chicken that looks like him. The executives will never know the difference. Henri giggled as Lucifer snuffled his sandaled feet. He pushed the porker away.
And they said they'd do that.
I shrugged. What choice do they have?
What about Emma?
Asked Melange, obviously relieved that the conversation had shifted.
I thought she hated that chicken biz. Is she staying in it?
No, she's not. Hattie will run rural choice by herself from now on. She's promised her sister that she will find a buyer for the company when Winston II dies and Chickenland becomes their sole property. Emma has borrowed money. Repeat, borrowed. She wouldn't let Hattie just give it to her. And she's opening a vegetarian health food store near her mother's shop down on Telfair.
And Rufus? She demanded. What you gonna do about that pig? Sorry, Lucy, she added, patting Lucifer on the head. Not all pigs are scum.
Nothing I can do about him. He hasn't done anything wrong that I know of. Still legal in this country to hate. I'm just glad he and Cornelia didn't come into the rural choice fortune. I dread to think what would have happened with his little paramilitary group if they had got enough money to purchase arms in large quantity. I shuddered as I imagined the damage Rufus could do.
It's done, and we've been paid then,
said Henri, dropping a strawberry into Lucifer's gullet. Yes, and it's a pretty penny. Hattie was grateful to get all this cleared up without a fuss. She kept repeating, "Thank God the police wouldn't listen to us." I have to agree with that. Anyway, she was grateful enough to fill the coffers of the agency quite generously.
"Long as I get paid, I don't care if those fat broads gave us 50 cents," grunted Melange.
I like that, Melange. Always thinking of the good of the company. Never a selfish thought in your head, huh? She glared at me. I smiled back at her innocently. Naz walked into the reception area as we were about to put Melange's cake in the small fridge in the supply room. I didn't know where he'd been, but he had a big grin on his face.
"Hello, everybody,"
he smiled.
"Happy birthday, Melange."
"Thanks, Naz," she called to him.
"Hiya, big guy," I said. "Care for some cake?" I've never seen anybody's face fall so fast in my life. He went from grinning one second to an utterly horrified look in the next. It was one of the weirdest transformations I'd ever seen.
"Cake?"
he stuttered.
"Sorry, Myron, I never touched the stuff."
He trembled violently. "Are you sure? It's chocolate and strawberry."
"Chocolate? No, definitely not. Sorry."
"Okay." Naz's weird reaction reminded me of something Cornelia Anderson had said. He hates cake because he was one of Marie Antoinette's serving girls during the French Revolution.
No, that couldn't be him.
No, not Naz. He was strange. But not even he was that strange. I looked up into Naz's face and sighed. In the case of Nazareth Pike, just about anything was possible. The end.
We hope that you have enjoyed our presentation of Hamlet and Eggs by James Campanella. Story copyright 2006 by James Campanella. The story was read by the author. Directed by Ellen Swenson. Engineered by Cephas McCoy. Produced by Arthur Guthrie Jr. Podcast by John Smalley. Incidental music provided by the Montclair State University Orchestra. Performance copyright 2006 by Uvula Audio. All rights reserved. For other Uvula Audio titles, please go to our website at www.uvulaaudio.com.